Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
A man in shadows and a reporter with the deadliest weapon of all, the power of the press.
Cover-up had little to do with Watergate. It was mainly to protect the covert operations. It leads everywhere. Get out your notebook. There's more.
That's a clip from the 1976 movie All the President's Men. These days, newspapers are floundering. So why are the presses still rolling on the silver screen? Hello, sweetheart. Get me rewrite. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
I'm Catherine Lanford. John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are both away, but I'm joined by Todd Zwillick. Hey, good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Catherine. Coming up at this hour, is Pakistan simply fighting for survival right now? And the nation's biggest banks get their government-issue report cards today. We'll talk about who's on the honor roll and who's headed to summer school. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
It's a grim day for the big three automakers. First, GM has confirmed it's closing 13 plants for up to 11 weeks this summer. GM's North American president, Troy Clark, says they have too many cars and need to get production in line with demand.
These are difficult decisions, but necessary in light of today's market and the need to position GM for future success.
GM will halt production on all but its most popular models. GM has not said how many workers will be affected. Then over at Chrysler, the Treasury says it's time to prepare the bankruptcy papers to file as early as next week. That's a shift. The Treasury had been telling Chrysler to work out a deal with its debt holders by April 30th. And at Ford, they posted billion-dollar losses last quarter. Ford still hasn't taken any government aid, and they also posted a billion-dollar loss today. Todd?
In Washington, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner will outline the administration's plan to clean up the U.S. banking system today. Geithner will also meet with members of the G7 ahead of World Bank and IMF meetings in D.C. this weekend. In Pakistan, Taliban militants say they're retreating from the city of Bunair. The Taliban had seized control of the city, which is near the Swat Valley region. Defense Secretary Gates appealed to Pakistan to take a firmer stance against insurgents.
My hope is that there will be an increasing recognition on the part of the Pakistani government that the Taliban in Pakistan are in fact an existential threat to the democratic government of that country.
The U.S. has warned Pakistan that failure to confront the Taliban could affect U.S.-Pakistani relations.
In Baghdad, we also have back-to-back suicide bombings that killed at least 60 people. That's after we had bombings yesterday that killed nearly 80. This morning, we'll have the latest numbers on durable goods and new home sales. The Dow and the S&P closed flat, the Dow at 79.57 and the S&P at 8.52. President Obama is pushing Congress to write new rules for the credit card industry. We want to hear your gripe.
I think that late payment fees are a real scam. I've been sending my payments to find out that if it arrives on a Saturday or a Sunday, that they will charge you even though it's due on Monday if they haven't opened your envelope. Each time that's happened to me, I've called and they have removed the interest accrued because of it.
So, what have those companies done to you and what are your tips for other people in a credit crunch? Tell us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Big question this morning, what kind of survival war should Pakistan be fighting? We had news yesterday that Taliban fighters were securing their hold in Bunair. That's territory less than 70 miles from the capital city of Islamabad. But now this morning, according to Pakistan government officials, Taliban militants have begun a withdrawal from the area. Now, as the story continues, questions remain. U.S. officials are still asking about the Pakistani government's willingness to take on the insurgents. Earlier this week, both Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton warned of the consequences if Pakistan didn't take a firmer stand against the Taliban. Here's Secretary Clinton.
We cannot underscore the seriousness of the existential threat posed to the state of Pakistan that are being made by a loosely confederated group of terrorists and others who are seeking the overthrow of the Pakistani state.
We're joined now by Ambassador Munir Akram. He was Pakistan's ambassador to the United Nations from 2002 to 2008. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's go back to this essential question. What kind of fight for survival is Pakistan fighting these days?
Well, we are fighting against militancy, but it's not an existential threat, and it is not a fight for survival. We have the capacity to defeat these militants, but we would not like to make war on our own people. And if it can be resolved peacefully, it should be resolved peacefully. So I believe that the threat, which is real and it's a matter of concern for us, but this should not be blown out of proportion, and it should be seen that we need a clear strategy. We need a strategy which has the support of our people in order to defeat militancy, and we have to be allowed the time and space to develop that strategy and implement it.
You know, you say that you don't want to have a fight against your own people, but there have been private citizens, private militias who have stood up to the Taliban. So obviously that fighting's already going on.
Well, there are several. It's a very complex situation. It's not the same in every region. But keep in mind that the area that is affected is about 2 to 3% of our total land territory. It's very mountainous and huge valleys. And we have to reestablish control, but we can do it through either peaceful means, political negotiations, or we can do it through militancy. Different tactics are applied in different places. If the militants are agreeable to have peace through political negotiations, we should aim for that, obviously, and we are doing so. But when they are militants which are bent upon violence against Pakistan, for example, in Bajor, our army has taken very strong action. And there is also evidence that in some areas there is foreign interference in the militancy, and we will take action against foreign interference. But if there are local militias, local people that we can negotiate peace with, we can bring them around, even over the long term, I think we should be allowed to do that and not make war on our own people. And such violence against our own people does not have the support of the general population of Pakistan. We need the support of the population in order to follow any strategy.
Ambassador, their ambitions are local. Yesterday, they were 70 miles away from Islamabad. What if local includes Islamabad?
No, this is the exaggeration. You're sitting from here looking at satellite pictures. 70 miles is long ways away. These are mountains. These are huge mountains and valleys. These guys are not just going to march down in Islamabad.
I think if anyone has the capability to get across those mountains, it would be those particular insurgents.
Yes, but, you know, we have a huge army. We can utilize the
army.
Why
is that army on the border with India instead of worrying about the Taliban?
No, that's not true. Our army is over 500,000 troops. We've got plenty of troops.
But the fighting has been left to a force of constables, and you have officials in this country very upset.
That's not true. The fighting has been left to people who know the area. These are the frontier corps. They are from the region. You cannot fight in the mountains with people who don't know the terrain, who have never fought in that area. So we have the right people in there. We don't have the equipment because the United States has not given us the equipment, all the high technology tracking, night vision, helicopters. We don't have that equipment. So we are fighting with one hand tied behind our back, even when we are fighting in Bajor. But we've done well when we have decided to fight. We have put it down. But the question is, we need the support of our people to have a fight. We're not going to launch into operations which do not have support. This agreement was negotiated by the regional government in Peshawar. And Pakistan is a federation. We have to be able to carry all the provincial governments with us. So, and this agreement in Swat was ratified by the parliament.
All right, Mr. Ambassador, you say there is no existential threat posed by these insurgents in Pakistan, but we just heard tape of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton using those very words.
I disagree with that.
And secretaries of state don't choose their words carefully. She said existential threat for a reason.
I choose my words very carefully. I'm from Pakistan, and she's not.
Okay, so but what do you make of her using those terms? Why would the American State Department and American officials?
Obviously, the Americans do want us to take on these people and fight the militancy because they see that there is an impact on their presence in Afghanistan. And it's vice versa. The American presence in Afghanistan, the war against the Taliban, is pushing many of these extremists across the border, and we are expected to fight them. But we can only fight them if we have the support of our people. Our people see this war, a large proportion of our people see this war as America's war, not Pakistan's war. And they question as to why we should be fighting against our own people, bombing our territory, where the U.S. predators go and hit our people and kill civilians while they are trying to kill the terrorists. This has made this war very unpopular. It's made the army unpopular. It's made the government unpopular. And if we are pushed in this direction into a pell-mell war against our own people, it will jeopardize our government. That's the existential threat we will face.
And what happens if members of Congress follow through on their threat to withhold non-military aid to Pakistan if this isn't stepped up?
Pakistan can do without American aid. This is my honest opinion. Well, how much money, whatever money is committed, half the aid comes back to the donors. There is, for so many years, you've promised aid. There is nothing has happened in the frontier, on the ground. There is no development that has taken place. Even if you commit the money now, it will come a year later with conditions and tie and all kinds of strings. It's not going to have a large impact on the ground. We can do without the aid because we can't be seen as to be a stooge in this war for America.
You've received $1 billion in American military aid each year, and you're saying you can just let that go.
Military, $1 billion, we get compensation, not military aid. The military aid has been limited so far to $300 million, and it's been mostly used to buy little spare parts and things like that. It's the real assistance we've asked against in the war on terror. We've asked for helicopters. We've asked for night vision equipment. We've asked for tracking equipment, electronic tracking equipment. We have not been provided that for the last 3 years that we've been requesting it. Why not?
I have to tell you, I'm just looking at the New York Times right here. It says the Army receives $1 billion in American military aid each year. So, again, this must be a language question. We're running out of time, and I want to give you an opportunity. If the military route is not the way here, what is the concrete thing that needs to happen for political stability to arrive in your country?
We need to pursue a strategy which is... which has a combination of political action with the militants. We need economic and social development. But where the militants are recalcitrant, where there is no hope of negotiating with them, then we need a military strategy and a police strategy and an intelligence strategy. We have in place. I'm not saying that these agreements are totally flawless. Yes, they could have been better. They could have been negotiated better. But for us, the first priority is to have the support of our people in this war. The second priority is not to kill our own people. And we have to look at the long term. We cannot, for a short-term gains, alienate a important province of Pakistan, the Pashtun. The people in the northwest frontier do not support this. We have to carry them along.
Ambassador, I'm afraid that is going to have to carry us to the end of this segment. I thank you so much for joining us. A pleasure to talk to you. Ambassador Munir Akram, former permanent representative to the UN from Pakistan. And, of course, if you have comments on this interview, we'd like to hear from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanford. Todd Zwillick and I are here this morning in place of John and Adora. Now, President Obama is pushing Congress to write new rules for the credit card industry. But we know you can do better, and we still want to hear your stories about being credit crunched. What have the companies done to you? What kind of fix would you like to see to the laws?
This is Lance Floyd in Kearney, Oklahoma. So I got a credit card with a 7.9 fixed rate on it, and I got a letter in the mail the other day. It said they're going to raise my rate to 13-some-odd%, and I was able to opt out of that. But the same day after my sister, but she just throws her junk mail away and didn't read it. And they raised her rate up to 24%, and her payment went from like $100 a month to $700 a month.
Ooh, you got to watch what's in the mail. Tell us your credit card gripes at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Todd?
Catherine, Congress has been talking about credit cards all week. They'll talk about it next week. But all week they've also been talking about cap and trade. Now, cap and trade is the policy at the heart of the global warming debate, the Democrats' big global warming bill. Republicans are dead set against cap and trade. And the reason in their message is that cap and trade is going to make your electric bills go up. And they say it's going to make your electric bills go up a lot. Now, that's their message. And the message machine is in full force.
According to an analysis by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology,
you might say it's just one study.
And holy cow, this month's electricity bill
to increase by $3,128 per year.
Where'd all this come from?
This study is completely consistent with everything else we know.
Now, the study they're talking about is from MIT. You heard that. And the man who wrote it is Professor John Riley. He's an MIT environmental economist. And it's fair to say, I think, that Professor Riley is deeply annoyed, maybe even mad as heck, that the Republican message machine is distorting and misrepresenting his data. Well, we've got him on the line, and we want to talk to him about what he thinks about how Republicans are using his study and what he thinks the real data are. Professor, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good. Thanks for joining us. Well, Professor, we'll get to some numbers in a second, but first I just want to lay it out. Republicans have spent weeks citing your study, saying that it concludes that the cap-and-trade system will cost every household in America an average of about $3,000 on their electric bills. Now, you wrote a very public letter to Republican leader John Boehner on April 1st, asking him and his caucus to stop doing it. Now, I was in a briefing with Republican Conference Chair Mike Pence just this week on Tuesday. You wrote your letter on April 1st, and I was in this briefing, and there was the MIT study again and $3,000 yet again. What do you make of this?
Well, I tried to explain to them why the number they're drawing from the study is a misinterpretation, but they've chosen not to change their view. The number is taken from what we said is the auction revenue that is raised by selling these allowances that would cap greenhouse gas emissions. And that auction revenue is revenue to the government that then would go back and be recycled to the people, citizens. And so that is not a proper estimate of the cost. So the cost is the amount of actions that people take to avoid paying the tax, kind of paying those extra prices, insulating their homes or buying more fuel-efficient vehicles. And so that's the real cost to the economy, and that's a very different number. Our estimate in 2015, instead of the 3,000 $128. They comp is more like $80 a family.
Yours is more like $80. Okay, but yeah. In addition to better insulation and more efficient appliances, we do expect electric bills, or if assuming that a home is heated with electric like most are, we do assume that electric bills, energy bills, would go up for households, correct?
Oh, yes. I mean, that is the whole point of a cap-and-trade system. The extra costs get put into electric bills, into cost of gasoline, into cost of natural gas. And so it's those higher prices that are the incentives to do something different. So those higher prices are there, and there will be a cost to consumers and households. And we tried to estimate that cost, but it's not the auction revenue that's collected.
Not the auction revenue. But one of the big debates here is how much of the auction revenue is returned to what's called ratepayers. Ratepayers are just people like you and me who pay electrical bills, or even businesses that pay electrical bills. And I'm assuming that the $3,000 number assumes that none of the money goes back to us, the consumers. Does your assumption assume that all of it goes back to consumers? Because that's not what Congress is talking about.
Yeah, so our assumption is that it all goes back to households.
Okay, well, I want to ask you about that, because in the halls of Congress where I work, the number that's sort of getting thrown around right now is people are sort of coalescing around 40%, that people think that what might go into this bill when it's finalized, and that could come as early as next week in the House, would be sort of a 40% return to households to help ratepayers lower this increase in their electrical bills. So what would your estimate be under if it were 40%?
Well, it's a little bit tricky, because when the government collects this money, they might return some amount of it directly to a check or in some way to consumers, saying this is some share of this auction revenue. But the rest of the money is used to perhaps have a lower deficit or provide other government programs. So that ends up somehow getting back and affecting the average household. Now, obviously, households are differentially affected by energy costs, and right, depending on how the money is spent or returned, it goes to one household and not to the other. So how the money is spent or used or returned to the households does have important impacts on households, but this average household that covers all people includes the money that's directly returned, or the reduction in taxes, or the lower deficit. So for the average person, it essentially is all returned, but the average, of course, doesn't deal with individuals.
And it probably doesn't include things like maybe gasoline costs and other fuel costs that aren't heating homes. My guest, Professor John Riley of MIT, is the author of the study that's being used in Congress as a cudgel in the cap-and-trade debate. Context is important, because you're going to be hearing a lot about this global warming debate. You got to know the numbers. Thank you for joining us. Well, Femi is here with the headlines.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour, we start with some international news. Taliban militants have been retreating from a seized part of northwestern Pakistan today. The government warned it would remove them by force. Television footage showed dozens of masked militants carrying automatic rifles fleeing from a villa in Bunair in the militant-heavy Swat Valley. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is sending an humanitarian team to northern Sri Lanka. Thousands are trapped in the crossfire between the government and ethnic Tamil Tigers. Nearly 6,500 Tamil civilians have been killed in the last 3 months. Calm overnight winds have brought some relief to firefighters battling a blaze in South Carolina. The blaze started west of Myrtle Beach on Wednesday and has burned 31 square miles of land, and almost 200 homes were damaged or destroyed. It's the worst wildfire in South Carolina since 1976. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual. dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, and today with Todd Zwillick. We have, of course, reports this morning from another attack in Iraq. We have had 5 bombings in barely 24 hours, the latest twin suicide bombers attacking the most important Shia shrine in Baghdad, killing at least 60 people, injuring at least 125 more as they gathered for Friday prayers. We go now to Baghdad and Stephen Lee Myers from our partner at the New York Times. Stephen, give us an update here. What is the latest that we're hearing about this attack?
It seems to have been a twin suicide attack. The bombers came up and mingled with the crowd as they were waiting to get into the shrine that you mentioned and blew themselves up nearly simultaneously, as near as we can figure.
All right. We have, if I'm doing the math here from your story in the Times, we have 5 bombings that have killed at least 140 people and wounded 240 people just within the last 24 hours. Put this in context for us. Is this the worst violence that we've seen?
One thing that even since then, there's been yet another bombing, though a smaller one, that has killed 2 more people in Diyala province, where one of the bombings yesterday also happened. I think what we're seeing here is what appears to be an upsurge of violence that the Iraqi authorities are scrambling to get a handle on, not very successfully, I think.
We've had today, of course, there were a lot of pilgrims who were attacked. We also see that many of the victims are Shiites. So tell me, is this religious in its context in terms of who's being attacked?
It seems very very clear that the last few attacks have targeted the Shiites in Iraq particularly. That and the use of suicide bombers is often an indication that al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-like groups here in Iraq are behind them. The Islamic State of Iraq, sort of the umbrella group for a lot of these extremist organizations, has claimed that they're targeting, they've launched a new campaign they call the Good Harvest, or the Harvest of the Good, which seems aimed, I think, at inflaming sectarian tensions again, as, you know, attacks in the past have done.
Now, I thought, according to the Christian Science Monitor, Iraqi authorities were saying just not that long ago that they had captured one of the leaders of the Islamic State of Iraq. Any connection between that?
Yesterday they announced that they had arrested Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, who's a sort of mythic figure, if you will, who's said to be the leader of the insurgency here, particularly the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Qaeda. Most people, including the U.S. military, think that this is a fictitious person, a figurehead. And in fact, today, the United States military said that they were unable to confirm, in fact, that this person, the purported head of the insurgency here, was arrested yesterday, as the Iraqis announced.
Stephen, we have to ask, what are the implications for the U.S. military presence there in Baghdad and in Iraq? I realize this is largely Iraqi on Iraqi violence that we're seeing, but what are you hearing from the U.S. military about how this affects their posture?
Well, I think in general, the military as well as the new administration believe that they're going to be able to continue a phased withdrawal of American forces over the course of the next 2 years. The fact is that not many American troops have yet withdrawn, so the numbers are still quite high. I think what's happening is they are pulling back a little bit from some of the cities and turning over much more control since the beginning of this year to Iraqi security forces. And you're right that that attacks do seem to be targeted on Iraqi civilians and Iraqi security forces. There have been attacks also this month that have killed American soldiers. So I think that there is a great deal of concern that any uptick in violence threatens the stability of this place. It hampers the political reconciliation process. It weakens the government. And, of course, that's a huge concern for the military as they prepare in the months ahead to really turn over more and more of this country to the Iraqi forces.
Right. And this might be a good time for an update. You know, the surge when we changed our Iraq policy and started putting a lot more U.S. personnel in forward positions and in neighborhoods, it helped a lot. Now you say we're starting to draw out of those neighborhoods and hand it over to Iraqi units. As this violence flares up, how well equipped are the Iraqi units in terms of their training and their know-how and their willingness to handle what seems like an upsurge in trouble there?
You know, it's really hard to say on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you certainly see much more Iraqi security presence on the street in Baghdad and elsewhere. In large parts of the country, there is a great deal of safety, or at least a general sense of safety. Whether or not the Iraqi forces are able to have the intelligence, both the human intelligence but also sophisticated electronic eavesdropping and so forth, that will help them detect and head off these kinds of attack, I think remains very much in question. I know the Americans are spending a lot of time training the Iraqi forces and say they're positive about the progress they've made, but I don't think anyone thinks they're quite ready yet.
Stephen, the victims of these attacks, you know, in the past, we've seen candidates for the police school, other soldiers. In this particular one, we have pilgrims, we have people lining up, women and children lining up to get humanitarian aid. We have busloads of tourists who take a break to pray. What does that tell us about this recent cycle of violence?
Well, I think generally I would say the targets seem to be Iraqi security forces, by and large. I mean, the women and children who were killed were receiving food packages from Iraqi forces. I think that, you know, like many terrorist attacks, they look for soft spots and soft targets that they're able to get to. The targeting of the shrine today and yesterday, a restaurant which was apparently quite full of Iranian tourists, seems to have been directed specifically at Iranians who are Shia and who come to the important shrines here in Baghdad and Karbala and Najaf elsewhere in Iraq. So those seem to have been singled out in order to attack both Shia but also Iranians who are visiting.
Stephen Lee Myers reporting to us from Baghdad. We thank you so much for your time. And now we turn to Femi Oke reporting to us from the Takeaway Newsroom.
Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The Ford Motor Company has posted a $1.4 billion first quarter loss. The second largest automaker spent $3.7 billion more than it made in the first 3 months of the year. And the last time Ford had an annual profit was back in 2005. General Motors will temporarily close 13 assembly plants in the US and Mexico, laying off 24,000 workers. The shutdown is to shrink bloated inventory, and the automaker is trying to get more concessions from its labor union and bondholders by June the 1st. And Chrysler is preparing for bankruptcy on orders from the Treasury Department. Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting that workers' pensions and retiree healthcare benefits will be protected, and the company could get an injection of an additional $6 billion from the government if it can reach deals for its solvency by the end of the month. Let's look at the big automaker stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. Catherine, here is a story of some intrigue from Bolivia. It's hard to say what's really true about this story, but here's what we do know.
Okay.
Government security forces last week killed a man from Ireland, a Hungarian, and a Croat in a hotel room in the Bolivian city of Santa Cruz. And the Bolivian president, Evo Morales, says the shooting was to thwart an assassination attempt by international mercenaries. Now, no one seems to know if that's actually true. But meanwhile, Morales has suggested that the American embassy and the American government was behind this alleged plot. Well, joining us now to sift through some of these murky details is Naomi Derenblum. She teaches Latin American politics at New York University. She's in the studio.
Good morning. Thanks
for joining us. Good morning. Naomi, no one seems to know if this alleged assassination plot was even really an assassination plot. True or not? Do we know?
Absolutely true. We really cannot assess it. So as best as I can summarize it, if it was an assassination plot, it was a very harebrained assassination plot. You have three guys that are dead, two guys that are in prison, but the government hasn't really released any information. The Irish and Hungarian governments have asked to get the details of the shootout, but Evo Morales has said that those questions are illegitimate. And if that these governments push to know more details, they probably were backing this attempt.
All right. Now, the ringleader, the Hungarian gentleman, I believe, before he left Hungary, did a television interview and said he was going to Bolivia. He's a dual citizen, and said that he was going to start a militia to help the semi-autonomous region of Santa Cruz potentially fight for his independence. But he said he wasn't going to harm the president. Now, he said he didn't have those intentions, but what, Morales doesn't believe him, or it's politics?
I think it's politics. Look, the histories of coups in Latin America, especially from what the leftist progressive governments call the oligarchy, is usually an oligarchic group allied with the military trying to bring down a leftist government. The military has taken a very neutral stance. They're not necessarily going into the provinces of Santa Cruz and quelling down anything. But they're also not allying themselves with the secessionists, if you want to call them that.
Okay, so what about the accusation then, or the insinuation that was made in Trinidad, I believe, from Morales, that the U.S. Embassy was behind this alleged plot? Is that just good sort of populist politics in Latin America for a president? What is that?
Well, when George W. Bush was in office, anti-Americanism was the one thing that could distract away from any problems. This is how Hugo Chavez won a lot of elections, by insulting George Bush. But with President Obama in office, that's a little harder. And sincerely, there is no ambassador. There's no one to lead the American charge. The United States has a lot on its plate. And I don't think that that Bolivia or bringing down Morales is even on the list of 100 things that any American government would want to do.
So maybe just good politics for Morales in his own country. But quickly, I want to ask you, President Morales originally said no international investigation into this shootout. He then changed his mind. He said, okay, international investigators, come in quickly. Why the change of heart?
The change of heart, sincerely, because he was sounding like a crackpot yesterday.
Even in his own country?
To any Latin American, to anybody from in any part of the world, if your citizen gets killed and you ask the government that killed him for an investigation just for details, that would be a logical thing to do.
All right. Naomi Derenblum teaches Latin American studies at New York University. Thanks for joining us, talking about Bolivia and the alleged assassination plot against President Evo Morales.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting here with Catherine Lamfer. We're sitting in for Adora and John this morning, and today we're talking about credit cards. Again, it's a big deal. President Obama and the Congress are both pushing to write new rules for the credit card industry. And we want to hear your complaints, and maybe not your complaints, maybe your good experiences with the credit card industry. Some of you think that the industry is going the way of the loan shark.
If Guido the loan shark loans us money at exorbitant rates, we call it usury and throw him into jail. If the credit card companies borrow at an effective rate of zero from the Fed and loan it to us at 29%, we call it banking.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Tell us your credit card stories at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
All right, let's move to some headlines here with Femi Okay.
Hello, good morning. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The U.S. and Russia are holding their first nuclear arms talks in more than a decade. Negotiators meet today in Rome to talk about a new arms treaty. The current strategic arms reduction treaty expires in December. In India, suspected communist rebels blew up a jeep carrying polling officials, killing five people. The Jeep was transporting electronic voting machines when they hit a landmine on Thursday. Election officials had to announce that citizens in the Eastern District would have to recast their votes, and the assault came just after voting closed in the Eastern District. The U.S. Army is taking new efforts to prevent soldiers' suicides. The Army has approved new rules for soldier care. Officials have said in the past that a new plan will include hiring more mental health care workers and improving the way drug and health screenings are carried out. And last year, the Army had a record number of soldier suicides. A memorial service has been held for 21 polo ponies who died suddenly on Sunday in Florida. The memorial service was held at the International Polo Club Palm Beach, where the U.S. Open Polo Championships is being held, and the horse's sudden death is now believed to have been caused by a deadly dose of a vitamin compound. So that's a look at stories making news this morning. Todd, Catherine.
All right. Thank you, Femi. We know how newspapers used to sound on the silver screen. Give a listen.
I got the tickets for the hanging here, boys.
Hey.
Huh? What?
Pete, why can't you hang this guy at 5 o'clock instead of 7?
Sure, it won't hurt you, and we can make the city edition.
Oh, well, now, that's kind of raw, Roy. After all, I can't hang a man in his sleep just to please the newspaper.
No, but you can reprieve him twice, so the hanging's 3 days before election, can't you?
Well, that's His Girl Friday. And here is how newspapers sound in the movies now.
Are you taking me off the story?
Well, watching seasoned reporters at work on a big story, you know, being part of it all, you'll learn a lot. So, Ted Moody, what do you think?
Don't let her do it.
Excuse me, you're defending her now?
She's fine. I can work with her.
But, Cal, she's inexperienced.
Inexperience isn't fatal.
I'm not giving up the story.
Ah, that's a clip from a movie that's in theaters right now. State of Play, with Russell Crowe as a hard-boiled investigative reporter in Washington. It's just one of two movies out right now where the big stars are newspapers. The other is The Soloist, that tells the story, the true story, of an LA Times columnist in the movie played by Robert Downey Jr., who helps a homeless man, once a musical prodigy. Of course, these days, if you're looking for a real weepy, just look at real newspapers. They're dying, filing for bankruptcy, cutting back on pages and delivery, and in many cases, they're shutting down. So why are they still showing up so healthy on the silver screen? Well, for the answer, we're going to turn to A.O. Scott. He's a movie critic at our partner, the New York Times, and we're really happy to have him in here this morning.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Okay, State of Play and The Soloist. Does this mean that the movie-going public is hungry for tales of newspaper daring do?
I don't know. It certainly means that the Hollywood studios are still believe that there's some mileage in the image of the heroic image of journalists and journalism. And it's sort of an interesting coincidence that these movies come out right at the time when anyone who's still reading the newspapers is seeing headlines about how the newspapers are all on the verge of collapse. I have to say that the very last, I didn't think State of Play was a particularly good movie, but the very last image of it over the closing credits of the plates being set and the presses running and, you know, these stacks.
Oh, hang on, I'm getting excited just
I know,
to talk about it.
I was watching it in a screening room, I think full of mostly print journalists, and we were all, you know, just weeping at the end. It's an odd movie, too, because that movie, I think, seems particularly curiously out of touch with the realities of the newspaper business. The Soloist is a little different because it's not centrally about the newspaper business. The main character is a journalist. You do see the environment that he works in. In fact, the Los Angeles Times allowed, you know, the film to be shot in their newsroom. But it's a somewhat more personal story about the relationship between this writer and this musician.
I think one thing that's intriguing is that in State of Play, they do try to make some nod of the head to the changing face of journalism, in that Russell Crowe portrays a print reporter,
right,
and then Rachel McAdams, who we heard in that clip, along
yes,
with Helen Mirren, she is the feisty blogger.
She's the blogger, and what she does, she works for the paper, but she writes the sort of their politics gossip blog. It's a Washington paper. And Helen Mirren, who was also in that clip, is the editor. And the interesting thing is that they have, Russell Crowe and Rachel McAdams have, I mean, it's completely without any sexual or romantic chemistry, but they have this kind of, you know, back and forth bantering relationship. But And he sort of sees her as this young upstart who's totally irresponsible, who just makes stuff up and puts gossip out there on
and
the web.
And he's totally grizzled and seasoned and overweight and probably drinks too much.
Right, and he has this messy desk and he has, you know,
sorry.
She doesn't even have
you just describe my perfect heartthrob.
At the end, he gives her a necklace made out of pens because she doesn't have any pens. She just uses her iPhone all the time. But the interesting thing about it is that the lessons that they have to teach, it all goes one way. So you would think, or it would be, I think, maybe a more interesting story if he learned something about, you know, journalism in the new media environment. But it all goes, she learns the importance of a good, solid story. He has some ethical problems of his own. He's working on a story about his former college roommate whose wife he used to sleep with. But he can apparently get through those with Rachel McAdams' help. But she says at one point, you know, she has this line where they're deep into the story and he says, well, aren't you going to put this up, you know, on the site, on the blog? And she says, no, you know, some stories are so important that they need to be on newsprint.
Well, I'm shocked to hear that movies sometimes do not portray life.
Well, it's a wonderful sentiment, you know, but if you want people actually to read the story in a timely way, you might want to put it up on the web.
You know, one thing that I can't help but notice, and this is more common on journalism than it is on films about newspapers, and that is that we have, as newspaper journalists, as journalists in general, we've covered so many industries that have either had to have wrenching change or die, and yet when it's our own industry...
Now it's our turn, right?
Well, then it is a tragedy. And I'm wondering if the way we're looking at these two films doesn't somehow relate to that.
Well, I think there's a lot of sentimentality certainly that journalists have about our own our own profession and our own jobs, and I think that goes back even into Flesher times, and I think some of that is actually reflected on screen. I mean, just as you were swooning over Russell Crowe, a lot of us over the years.
And by the way, it wasn't Russell Crowe. It was the image of him as a newspaper guy. All right, just want to be clear.
Gotcha,
there.
Gotcha. He's looked better, I'll say, than in this film. But you know, this idea of us as sort of these hard-bitten, cynical, but ultimately idealistic crusaders after the truth. We're not in it for ourselves, but just we're going after the story.
You're,
we're going for the truth.
You're making me cry.
Yeah, we get all choked up.
All right, quickly, for the non-newspaper people listening to this, State of Play, should you go or not?
No.
Okay, so The Soloist.
Sure.
Okay, that was a hands in the air. A.O. Scott, I hope you come back.
I hope so, too.
A.O. Scott is a New York Times film critic. Todd?
So earlier today, we were joined by Munir Akram, Pakistan's ambassador to the United Nations from 2002 to 2008. He spoke about the latest on Pakistan's fight with Taliban fighters.
Pakistan can do without American aid. Now, this is my honest opinion. Well, how much money, whatever money is committed, you know, half the aid comes back to the donors.
You had some strong reactions to that conversation. Some of you agreed.
What that man was saying, as grating as it was and as unappealing as it was to our ears as Americans, he really does have a point there. They do have to come on board, and we have to help them do that.
Some of you agreed, and some of you did not.
We're not giving you the necessary equipment, but we are giving you $1 billion a year. Why don't you go buy it?
All right, a lot of reactions to the Pakistani ambassador and his comments saying that Pakistan doesn't really need U.S. aid.
Well, you know, and we have so many things for you to react to this hour. What about that latest news, breaking news here on The Takeaway from Iraq? Also, of course, want to know why you think newspapers are healthier on the silver screen than they are in real life. So many things for you to tell us about at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I'm Catherine Lamb.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for joining us this morning on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The president and the Congress are taking on the credit card industry by rewriting the credit card laws, but maybe they should take a lesson from Takeaway listener Don Merrill of Salt Lake City, Utah. Don, what did you do to your credit card company?
I had to sue him.
You had to sue him. And why did you have to sue him?
Because they kept sending me convenience checks.
Convenience checks? Are those high-interest checks that give you easy cash from your credit account but charge you tons of interest?
Yes.
And you took him to court. Did you win?
Yes.
And then, did the checks stop coming after that?
Yes.
Well, Don Merrill, keeping the credit card companies in check, that's what we're doing on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting here with Catherine Lamfer. We're in for John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji this morning. Catherine, how are you?
Hey, Todd. I'm all right. In this hour, we look at credit problems that led to a government meltdown and now new elections in Iceland, along with a peek at the cars of the future and, would you believe it, moon dust? Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
Big news from the big three automakers today. Ford just posted a $1 billion loss last quarter. GM is closing production lines this summer, and Chrysler better get ready to file those bankruptcy papers. The Treasury Department, meanwhile, is changing its policy on Chrysler. The government told Chrysler to have bankruptcy filings for Chapter 11 ready as early as next week. The Treasury's been pushing Chrysler to work out a deal with its debt holders by April 30th or forfeit more federal aid that it has coming to it. And GM is confirming it's closing 13 plants this summer to reduce inventory. GM will close the plants in waves for up to 11 weeks. GM has not said how many workers will be affected, Catherine.
The nation's 19 biggest banks get their government report cards today. Those stress tests and their results will be made public on May 4th. And in Washington, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner lays out the administration's plans to clean up the U.S. banking system today. Geithner will also meet with members of the G7 ahead of World Bank and IMF meetings in Washington, D.C. this weekend. And the Justice Department has ordered the release of more than 40 photos depicting prisoner abuse by U.S. personnel in Iraq and Afghanistan. The ACLU says the photos will prove that prisoner abuse is widespread.
In Pakistan, Taliban militants say they're retreating from the city of Bunair. The Taliban had seized control of the city, which is near the Swat Valley region. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen spoke with NBC's Ann Curry. He says he's worried the government isn't doing enough.
I think we're certainly closer to the tipping point. I don't think that we're there, but events continue to move in the wrong direction.
Now, the U.S. has warned Pakistan that failure to confront the Taliban could affect U.S.-Pakistani relations.
In Baghdad, back-to-back suicide bombings killed at least 60 people and injured another 125 this morning. The suicide bombers detonated explosive belts outside an important Shiite shrine in Baghdad just before prayers. And just reported on The Takeaway, another bombing hit the Diyala province, killing two yesterday. That's from New York Times reporter Stephen Lee Myers. Looking to Wall Street, looks like the Dow and the S&P closed flat. The Dow opens this hour at 79.57, the S&P at 8.52. We're looking for how you've been caught in the credit crunch. Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting here with Catherine Lamfer. Well, here is an all-too-familiar story these days. People who pay their credit cards on time every month, and still they're seeing their interest rates go up and seeing all sorts of new fees pop up on their monthly statements. It happens all the time. Well, for President Obama, for one, says he's had quite enough.
I think that there has to be strong and reliable protections for consumers. Protections that ban unfair rate increases and forbid abusive fees and penalties. The days of any time, any reason, rate hikes, and late fee traps have to end.
Okay, well, that's the bully pulpit. You'd think he thought this up himself, but Congress has actually been working on this since last year and probably from the year before, but that's the way it goes when you're president. You get to claim the ideas, but it looks like they're going to get that bill done this year. Well, yesterday the president did meet with the credit card industry CEOs at the White House, apparently to pressure them to change their business practices, and it looks like Congress may well do it for them. Then again, he may not need their help because Congress is on the case, of course. Well, joining us now, Cindy Wyckoff and Mark Boettcher are both from Detroit, and they're joining us from their homes in Michigan. They are listeners to our show, and they called in yesterday. Good morning, Cindy and Mark.
Good morning.
Good. And joining us also in the studio is Alvin Hall, the Takeaway contributor and financial advisor. Well, Mark, you seem to have been punished for building a good credit record and then having your fees raised after that. Tell us what happened to you.
I had started with a local bank's credit card back in the early to mid-1990s. After a number of mergers, the limit was up to $25,000, and for about a decade during my undergrad and grad school, I had paid off balances at various times from anywhere from 12% to 20%, and in 2005, I was rewarded, if you will, with a 2.99 for the life of the loan, I thought, and so I maxed that out at 2.99% and paid off some school, paid off a vehicle, paid off some other credit cards, and put it on auto debit immediately so I wouldn't have to worry about any late payments, you know, any one day late, let alone a 30-day. And apparently that wasn't good enough. In December of last year, I received a notice that my minimum payment would be more than doubling from about $240 to over $600, and also that I would be incurring a annual fee of $120 regardless of whether I had a balance.
All right, well, Alvin, our Takeaway financial contributors here in the studio, Mark's story, does it sound familiar to you?
Oh, very familiar. What happened at one point in the industry was that they gave all these good deals and then they regretted it. And then gradually within state laws and various legislative changes, they were able to open up those. So when he got some statements later on, there would be these little notices on the statements that some aspects of the loan had changed. Now, Mark could go out and fight this, but chances are he would not win because the credit card companies decided that someone like Mark, of whom they were not making that much money anyway, was not that valuable to them ultimately. That's what happened.
But what they're trying to do is squeeze more money out of him by raising
exactly.
his fees, because he's not paying enough in interest or late fees. They need to squeeze it out of him another way, essentially.
Exactly. And they had locked him into this low interest rate, which they then regretted. So they could change it willy-nilly.
All right. Well, let me turn to Cindy Wyckoff, who's on the line with us. Cindy, you paid down your debt, right? But just like you'd agreed to, but they started penalizing you after you paid down your debt. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, I negotiated a payment plan with my credit card company, and paid according to that negotiation, and they reopened the card, sent me a new card, and just recently I received my first payment, my first statement, and my payment not only doubled, but my interest rate went from 5% to 27%.
Wow.
That's wrong.
And that, what they called a reasonable APR.
So, Alvin, what was her crime? Not paying enough interest, and so they raised her rate?
No, actually, what she did was absolutely perfect. She adhered to the terms of the agreement, but they willy-nilly decided that they didn't believe that she had enough money to actually be able to hold to this agreement. So, therefore, in order to extract even more money from her, they just upped everything, hoping, therefore, she wouldn't call, she wouldn't negotiate, or anything like that.
Alvin, how can this happen?
It's happened because of the law changes in the 1970s when they got rid of usury laws and fees regarding credit cards in America. All those companies moved to places like Iowa and Idaho. We remember when Citibank moved out there, and it allowed them to take advantage of state laws that did not have caps on interest, caps on fees, and then gradually they were able to lobby state by state.
Wait, so they're growing potatoes and usury out there?
Exactly. They had no usury laws out in Idaho during that period of time. So Citibank and all these companies moved out there, and they were able to raise rates and then lobby across America. And it started that great pendulum swing all the way over to the period that we end now called fee and interest rate madness.
Madness. Cindy, are you still there?
Yes, sir.
Good. Let me ask you about your card now. They raised your interest rate up to 27%. You mentioned that. And somebody might say, well, this is a business arrangement, a loan arrangement between you and the credit card company. They have a right to raise those rates, and you have a right to shop for another card. But do you feel like you were misled, or are you just mad that they changed the game on you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it goes back to those usury laws being, there's no limit on them, and there's no federal limit, and that's the problem. These companies are out, like feds are out in South Dakota and Delaware, and, there has to be a limit on what they consider a reasonable rate, which I don't think more than doubling my credit card payment is a reasonable rate.
All right. Well, you say there has to be limits, and it appears that Congress is working on some of those limits. Cindy and Mark, I want to thank you both for joining us and giving us your stories. And I want to turn to Alvin now, because Congress, like we said before, is on the case, and the president is on the case, too, and they're making a lot of press with a new credit card reform law. We have a bill in the Senate and a bill in the House, and it could be a matter of weeks before it's passed. Now, usury laws you discussed.
Yes.
And getting rid of what some people say are smoke and mirrors in the credit card industry, moving balances from month to month, ostensibly to squeeze more money out of people who aren't paying enough. I want to know off the top what your opinion is of the reform bills that we have in Congress right now. Are they going to solve the problem, or like so many things that Congress do, does it go halfway because the banking industry only lets them go halfway?
It goes halfway.
Okay.
To be blunt, I think that the credit card industry and the lobby is so strong, and they're able to argue to Congress quite effectively that their business model would undermine their profitability for their shareholders. So shareholder value would be eroded, and their business model is vital to America. Indeed, credit cards are important to us. I could not travel without my credit card. We could not function day to day. But do they need to earn 27% or in some cases 32% interest on credit cards? No. Congress needs to look at this and say to the credit card companies, listen, if you change interest rates on a customer, you need to give them some time to adjust to this. Giving them a mere 45 days, which is, I think, what
the
law says.
That's what's in the bill, 45 days.
Exactly. Is wrong. It needs to be 90 days. People need 3 months at least to find another place where they could move that money or get another line of credit. So a longer period would allow them to adjust. They also need to get rid of that practice of when you make a payment against double balances, balances that have two different interest
rates.
Right,
now that means if I carry a balance of $1,000 and I pay $900, I could still get charged interest for how many billing cycles? On the $1,000, not the $100 I still owe.
Exactly. It depends upon the billing cycle of your particular credit card, because all of them now have different credit cards. A friend of mine recently up in Connecticut who pays his bills in full every month got hit with interest rates on his credit card because they had changed the billing cycle down to about 15 days from the time he got his bill. So therefore, even though he paid it on time, he was unaware of this.
Did he? And he got no notice of that, or he didn't read the fine print?
He only got the notice of it when he got the second bill after he paid off the bill in full, saying that he still had an outstanding balance. And he called up, needless to say, he was explosive on the phone.
Okay, so real quickly, there's another aspect of these bills called anytime, any reason rate increases that they're trying to do away with. Has Congress gone far enough to get rid of what's called anytime, any reason rate hikes?
I think that's the one thing they are looking precisely at. They need to just wipe that away the way they wiped away that thing that allowed them to charge any fees if you missed a credit card. Universal default clauses were basically moved away. So getting rid of that anytime charge is really, really important. So I think that's the one thing that Congress knows they have to get rid of.
And the one thing they've done right. Alvin Hall is the Takeaway Financial Advisor. He joined us to talk about credit cards and some of the problems that consumers are facing. Pardon me, and whether Congress is doing enough. And I want to thank Takeaway listeners Mark Betcher and Cindy Wyckoff from Detroit, who joined us with their stories of fighting credit card companies.
Oh, we know that you have stories about being credit crunched. We'd like to hear from you. What have they done to you, or maybe you know how to handle them?
I had two companies who had sold the credit card debt two and three times. Two companies owned the same debt once and three the other time. They all had different amounts. I asked for verification of the debt that it is mine, and they had nothing to prove that it was my debt.
Ooh, now that's strategy. Tell us your strategy, your stories, at 1-877-78-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Todd Zwillick. Catherine Lamfer is here with me. We're sitting in for John and Adora today. Well, President Obama and Congress are pushing hard to rewrite the rules for the credit card industry, and we still want to hear your stories about being credit crunched. What have the companies been doing to you? Or maybe you have had a good experience, like Michael from New York.
I had missed a payment when I thought I had done it by automatic withdrawal, and I didn't find out until a couple of weeks after the fact. And they actually called me because I'm not that kind of a consumer to pay his bills late. And they actually reversed the credit fees. They actually reached out to me.
All right, so it's not all intimidation and doom and gloom and smoke and mirrors from the credit card companies. They reached out to him, and they did it in a good way. Tell us your credit card stories at 1-877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to hear from you. Catherine.
All right, Todd. When we think about news concerning automakers and news concerning cars, it's not good. Ford Motor Company just this morning posted a $1.4 billion first quarter loss, and that was the good news.
That was the good news. The White House is getting ready to lean on Chrysler to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and they have to do it by April 30th. After all of the auto bailouts, not enough for Chrysler. They look like they're going under. GM has pension troubles.
Exactly. Yep. So you might think, given all this talk, that all car news is bad news. But this week, Public Radio International Studio 360, the weekly arts and culture radio program, is going to take a trip through the car culture of Los Angeles.
Riding along in my automobile. My baby beside me at the wheel.
My name is Charlie Wint, and this is my mistress. It's a 1964 Ford Falcon, about the only mistress my wife will let me have.
Cruising and playing the radio.
That's host Kurt Anderson. He talked to hot rodders, low riders, and car designers working outside Detroit. Make that way outside Detroit. And he took a ride in a three-wheeled electric car straight out of the Jetsons. He's here now to tell us about it. Good to have you here, Kurt.
Great to be here.
Now, the news from Detroit and Washington is bad, but as we said, you were in L.A. What does the future look like? Better yet, what does the future ride like?
Well, I rode in this Aptera, which is this electric car.
It sounds like something you'd put on your face or take for a gastrointestinal disease.
Exactly. It's actually, I think, an ancient Greek word meaning flightless bird or something. But and it does indeed look like a flightless bird. It looks like a Jetsons vehicle that doesn't quite get off the ground. But it's an extraordinary looking thing. And moreover, being in this beautifully aerodynamic little car that goes 90 miles an hour if you push it, entirely on a plug-in charge, is kind of amazing.
Hey, listen, we have some sound here from Steve Fambro. He is the co-founder of the company that makes Aptera.
It looks like it might fly.
Well, it does fly right by a gas station, we like to say. A lot of folks have said, look, if you had little wings that pop out, wouldn't it be a great Bond car?
He's clever.
He's a CEO. Give him a break. He made this thing in his garage. And it is, and now it's this big company that they're going to start selling these things for $25,000 or $30,000 later this year. And it's just one of several electric car companies that are making a serious play that are in Southern California. And I'll tell you, you know, being out there in Southern California, talking to these people, being part of this car culture as this Detroit news was happening, it was an entirely different way of looking at the automotive world.
And how much of this do you think Detroit might wake up and act on?
I think, isn't it a little late for Detroit to wake up? However, GM, to its credit, has been putting all its bets on this hybrid car, mainly electric car they have, called the Volt, which they hope to get out to market next year or the year after, if they're around.
And does that mean the Chevy Volt members of Congress where I work are talking about cap and trade this week. We keep talking about the Chevy Volt like it's the future of our energy independence. You're frowning like they're still way behind the curve. Does the Aptera that you saw in California indicate that Detroit again is going to get left behind on the Volt?
Well, they may get left behind on the Volt because of GM's enormous problems. What's interesting about the Aptera and Washington is because it's on three wheels, which they've determined is just as stable and much more aerodynamic than four wheels, they aren't eligible thus far for the new stimulus package electric car funding that's come out. Which
is there a four-wheel clause in the stimulus? Is that what you're telling me?
Precisely. That federal traffic laws don't regard a three-wheel car as a car but as a motorcycle. So it's one indication of how Washington is a little slow to catch up with the cutting edge of solving our problem.
I want to go back to the hot rod culture, just the car culture that you found in Los Angeles. What intrigued you about that? Why did you go out there to look at that?
Well, I was already out there for a while and driving more as a result in the last couple of months than I had driven in the previous 20 years. And once you go deeper into that and you see how into cars everyone is and then how obsessively, fetishistically various subcultures are, it's just fascinating. I mean,
why is L.A. so car crazy?
Well, because it's the first metropolis, big city, really built around the idea of a car. So they are simply embracing the inevitable, that you're in your car all the time. Traffic has gotten worse, so you're in your car even more. And it's a city about cars. And they are unapologetically devoted to their cars, like some people are to, say, children or pets.
My guest, Kurt Anderson, is the host of Studio 360, a co-production of PRI and WNYC. And that show, all about L.A.'s car culture, will be this Saturday. And now we're all about news and Femi Okeh.
Thanks, Catherine. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. President Obama will remember Armenians killed by Ottoman Turks during World War I today in an annual presidential address. But the statement could be a little bit risky. Scholars view the killing of 1.5 million Armenians as genocide, but Turkey doesn't. The president will have to decide whether to tread lightly in his statement or risk offending an important Middle East ally. California is now the first state to adopt a mandate that requires low-carbon fuels at its pumps. Regulators approved the measure as part of new emission standards that go into effect in 2010. The new rule is expected to slash the state's gasoline consumption by a quarter in the next decade, and it could set the stage for a national policy on alternative fuels. Health officials are investigating a never-before-seen form of swine flu. Seven people were infected in California and Texas from late March to early April, and the victims have all recovered, but how they caught the flu remains a mystery. The flu combines pig, bird, and human viruses in a way that researchers have not seen before, and federal health officials are now locating everybody who has had contact with the victims. And that's a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning. Todd, Catherine, back to you.
Femi, thank you so much. Disturbing news.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, and I'm here with Todd Zwillick. We're in for John and Adora.
President Obama is pushing Congress to write new rules for the credit card industry, and we'd like to know what battles you fought. Here's something that a woman named Catherine wrote to us. I had a card that hit me with late fees twice in a row before I noticed it because they changed my payment date. When I got the bill, the due date was so soon that unless I sent the payment that day, I would have incurred a $50 late fee. I sent in that payment right away and never used that card again. Tell us your credit card gripe and your success stories at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Todd?
Well, credit and banks have also been a huge story in Iceland. It might be a different kind of credit they're talking about, but the last time that country made headlines, its economy was spinning into free fall because of the banks. And last year, its banking system collapsed after years of prosperity. And in the aftermath, the government fell and an interim government took over. Now, with the economy still flailing, Iceland's about to hold its very first elections since the credit crisis began. So can the U.S. learn something from a country that's looking at a political solution for an economic disaster? Well, joining us to talk about it is Bjorn Malmquist. He's a reporter with Iceland's National Broadcasting Service. Good morning, Bjorn.
Good morning.
How bad economically are things in Iceland right now?
Depends on who you talk to. The government wants to tell us that things aren't just as bad as have been reported in recent months. The companies are screaming for lower interest rates. Companies who are making business in other countries want us to join the EU, otherwise they will move away. Unemployment is rising, and our mortgages and our loans are going up every day. So, as I say, it's a matter of perspective, but things are pretty bad here.
And let me ask just quickly, what about people's deposits? Does Iceland have, in this country, we have an FDIC that insures people's bank deposits? I have to assume you have the same thing in Iceland. Has anyone lost money on their cash?
Well, we didn't lose money on our bank deposits, but a lot of people lost money on their money market accounts, and a lot of people lost money on their stocks, because a lot of people had stocks in the banks, in the three banks that toppled last winter, and those stocks are now worthless.
Okay.
And so a lot of people lost a lot of money.
All right, well, it's a true crisis in Iceland, a true crisis. What has it done to the election? How is the election shaping up? It's going on tomorrow. How has the failure of the huge banking industry in the small country affected the political debate?
Well, the short version is the country is leaning way to the left in the elections. All the polls indicate that.
We in this country think Iceland is already way to the left, so even further?
Well, it's the old story of the European socialists, right?
Right.
we did have a slightly right of center government before the fall, the social democrat by American standards, by our standards, pro business government that had been basically in power here for the last 18 years. What's going to happen now is it's very likely that the current alliance between the Social Democrats and the Left Green Party, which formed an interim government in February, that's probably going to continue after the election. So they will hold power for the next 4 years, most likely. So that's why I'm saying it's leaning to the left.
Bjorn, some outside observers, I'm thinking of an article that was in Der Spiegel yesterday, are saying that is not necessarily leaning to the left as much as it is leaning to the female side of the nation. That in both the banking industries and in politics, there are women who are saying, look, it's time for us to clean up after the old guard, who were the men who wore the same suits and went to the same schools.
That is true. The current prime minister is a woman. She's very likely to continue in that seat.
Johanna Sigurdóttir?
Johanna Sigurdóttir, yeah. She is now the head of the Social Democratic Alliance, and she's one of the oldest parliamentarians in the country, and very trusted and very popular.
And talk about what this election is going to do in terms of the way Iceland looks at it, participation in the European Union. I mean, there are people in the EU who are going to say, well, being in the EU didn't help us that much either.
Well, I mean, you know, these elections tomorrow are basically about economic policy for the next years, and you know, a major part of this discussion is whether we should join the EU. Mm-hmm. This has been talked about for years in Iceland. You know, the usual arguments against it is that by that we would lose control over our fishing grounds,
right,
and we would possibly lose control over our energy resources, which are abundant here. But since last September, it's become more and more clear for more and more people in this country that we cannot go this alone. We need to join the EU just in order to stabilize the economy. We cannot continue with the smallest floating currency in the world, the Icelandic krona, which has been basically in free fall since September. And so this is the major, this is really the major issue in these elections.
Right.
And
Bjorn, can I ask a very basic question? What's voter turnout in Iceland? What percentage of people are going to vote?
It's between 90% and 100%.
Between 90% and 100%. Well, here in the States, we're lucky to get 50 people. 50. That's amazing. Well, I'd like to thank my guest, Bjorn Malmquist. He's a reporter with the Icelandic National Broadcasting Service. He's speaking to us from Reykjavik about Iceland's upcoming parliamentary elections to be held on Saturday amidst the country's worst economic crisis probably in its history. Well, it's time for headlines now, and Femi is here.
Thanks, Todd. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Automaker Chrysler is preparing for bankruptcy on orders from the Treasury Department. Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting that workers' pensions and retiree health care benefits will be protected. The company could get an injection of an additional $6 billion from the government if it can reach deals to remain viable. The Pentagon is set to release photos of prisoner abuse under the Bush administration in Iraq and Afghanistan. The American Civil Liberties Union says that the photos will be visual proof of the abuses that took place beyond just Abu Ghraib. The ACLU filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit in 2004. Firefighters in South Carolina have some relief from calm overnight winds last night, helping to stem the spread of a blaze near a major tourism hub. The blaze started west of Myrtle Beach on Wednesday and has burned 31 square miles of land, and almost 200 homes were damaged or destroyed, and it's the worst wildfire in South Carolina since 1976. And finally, to South Africa. South Africa's ruling party is heading for a decisive victory in its parliamentary election. You can hear the crowds and supporters of the ANC already celebrating, but officially the results won't come out until Saturday. But the ANC is expected to win. Let's look at your news for now. Thanks.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Catherine Lanfrey. You're listening to The Takeaway. All this week, we've been hearing credit card stories from our listeners, and one man's story, well, it really caught us. Don Merrill is from Salt Lake City, and he was sick of all the so-called convenience checks that he got in the mail from his credit card company. You know, those high-interest checks that make it way too easy to borrow money on credit. So he sued, and he won. We've got him here on the line. Okay, Don, why were you so fed up about this one thing? Wasn't it just junk mail? You could have thrown it away.
I know I could have, but it was a respect issue. I mean, a lot of the credit card companies talk about how they are customer friendly. But if I make my wishes clear and I'm a good customer and they ignore my wishes, then it's not about the card anymore. It's about how I'm being treated as a customer.
So how did this escalate into a lawsuit?
Well, it escalated because since I got the card, I used the card responsibly, and probably after about a year of owning the card, I started getting these offers that were filling up my mailbox. And I have a mailbox on the street And there had been reports of people having mail stolen out of their box. Mm. So first I tried to get the post office to allow me to move my box from the street to the house, which they wouldn't let me do. So then I asked the credit card company to just stop sending me these offers. I mean, it was a simple request, but they just seemed to accelerate the offers.
Wow. And so how many letters did you send?
At the end of the two-year period, I had ended up sending about 35 or 40 certified letters.
Wow. So after all of that, what was the next step? You took them to small claims court?
I did.
And what happened then?
Well, I was awarded the judgment, and then the company contested what they called was the service, the way the suit was served to them. But what I did was I found a local company that was acting as their agent. They were doing the billing and the payment collection. And so I found their registered agent and sued both companies through that registered agent. It's kind of an involved process, but basically you have to find a legal representative of the company you want to sue in the city that you're in. And because this company was not represented locally directly, it was represented through its agent. So I sued the agent and ended up suing them both.
Now, you went through all of this. I'm assuming that you kicked that credit card company to the curb and said, get out of here. I don't want to deal with you anymore.
No. I mean, I still have the card. In fact, I just paid off my bill. I had a small balance, and I just paid it off. I like the card. I like the company. But this is not about the card per se. It's about it's about respect.
So what would your advice be? You know, we've been hearing from angry consumers, and they've got a right to be, all week long. As we wrap this up, what is your advice to other consumers?
Well, I think people have to be responsible and not get themselves into more debt than they can afford. But I also think people have to be vigilant and not necessarily believe all the happy talk that comes out of companies when they say, we're your friend and we want to be part of your family and we have your best interests at heart. They're a business. They're about making money. They have a fiduciary responsibility to bring in as much revenue to their shareholders as possible. It's not a friendship. It's not a love relationship. It's a business relationship. And people just need to be as vigilant to them as they are to us.
Don Merrill, tough love. Thank you for it, though.
Thank you.
That's Don Merrill, credit card consumer. Don't take him with, you know, don't take him with less respect than he deserves. That goes for the rest of you, too. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake at thetakeaway.org. We'd love to hear your response and your credit crunch story.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanford. Now it's time to go to the newsroom and to get the latest headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, Catherine. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The nation's 19 biggest banks get their government report cards today, and those stress tests will be made public on May the 4th. And in Washington, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner lays out the administration's plans to clean up the U.S. banking system. Secretary Geithner will also meet with members of the G7 ahead of World Bank and IMF meetings in D.C. this weekend. In Pakistan, Taliban militants are retreating from the city of Bunair. The Taliban had seized control of the city, which is near the Swat Valley region. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Michael Mullen spoke with NBC's Anne Curry. He says that Pakistan isn't doing enough to stop the Taliban.
I'm increasingly both concerned and frustrated at the progression of the danger.
Earlier this month, Pakistan made a deal with the Taliban imposing Islamic law in Swat, and the U.S. has warned Pakistan that if it doesn't confront the Taliban, it will hurt diplomatic relations. North Korea says it will try two American journalists accused of entering their country illegally. State media says the authorities have finished questioning the two women and that they will be brought to court. The women work for Current TV, and they have been reporting in China before they were detained in March by North Korean officials. And finally, a rare collection of early paintings by the Nazi leader Adolf Hitler has been sold for more than $100,000 at an auction in the United Kingdom. The artwork was found by a British soldier in Germany at the end of World War II, and the collection includes some scenic watercolours, some oil paintings, even a self-portrait. So what kind of person would buy a Hitler painting? How about John Ratledge here? And he doesn't seem perturbed, but a painting that he's bought was painted by Hitler.
There's lots of other mementos of the Second World War, other wars, First World Wars. So I don't think it's particularly upsetting.
Adolf Hitler failed to get into the Vienna Academy. He did want to be an artist. How the world would be different if he'd got in.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Femi.
All right, Femi, don't go anywhere.
Okay.
Because it's time.
Oh, yes, don't tease me.
We're going to space.
Oh, yes!
It's time to go to space. We're going to space. I've been waiting for this, Femi. Catherine, NASA says it wants to make another lunar visit a priority. Of course, the first one was in 1969. Just yesterday,
yes,
some new details came out about a study giving us some new facts about moon dust.
Brilliant.
And its composition. Stop it, please. Now, moon dust, in case you didn't know, I know you're interested in this, is quite sticky, and that can be a real problem for equipment and armor in space. Until now, no one knew that. Well, joining us now is our friend and longtime science broadcaster, Miles O'Brien. We're going to talk about the moon, but we have a lot of ground to cover. Not really ground, a lot of space to cover. There's a lot of fantastic stuff going on in the sky right now. You don't understand how excited I am. Miles,
ooh,
welcome.
Yes, we do.
Todd, it's a great pleasure.
Yes,
it's a great
pleasure.
Hey, happy Hubble Day, by the way.
We're
19 years ago today, where were you?
He was probably five, but...
Not quite. I was in college, but I am celebrating later on today, and believe me, Hubble Day is not lost on me on the anniversary of the Hubble telescope. And there's some news on Hubble, too.
Yeah.
It's about to get an upgrade. Let's go to the
a
moon
makeover.
First. Let's go to the moon first.
Yeah, let's go.
What do we know about lunar dust that we didn't know before, and why is it important?
Well, it appears the astronauts ought to bring some Downy fabric softener when they head up to the moon, because this dust, well, think about it for a moment. As we orbit the sun, we are bombarded by all these ions from the sun. It's called the solar wind. Now, we have a magnetic field on our planet which protects us from all that. The moon doesn't have that. And so what happens is that all that little talcum powder dust up there gets charged magnetically. It gives that staticky kind of thing, and it sticks to everything. This is a big deal if you're thinking about building some kind of moon colony, because if you want to put solar arrays down, scientific devices, equipment could overheat. And, of course, the stuff gets on all the gear and all the clothing, the outer clothing. And ultimately, it could be breathed by the astronauts who live there, and it could be a problem. So this is one of the little things that they have to deal with, seemingly little, could be a very big deal in the long run.
Potentially a deal breaker. All this research is prompted by NASA's saying that the moon is a priority for them, of course. We've already been there. But how much of a priority is this, and how likely is a return to the moon, do you think? I mean, everybody's talking about Mars already, so how likely is a return to the moon?
Well, I mean, NASA wants to get to the moon, but they may not have the money right now to do that. As it stands right now, they're talking about moving that expected day back to perhaps as late as 2020 or even beyond. A lot of people ask me that. Why would we been there and done that? Why would we go back? Well, if you want to go to Mars someday, if that is the goal of the space program, and a lot of people would say that would be a very interesting endeavor, you need to learn a lot of things about how to live in a distant place. You know, just to have a conversation with an astronaut on Mars, it's 20 minutes out and 20 minutes back. The punchlines for jokes kind of get delayed on those things, right?
Hey, they get delayed around here, and we have a lot less of a latency than
that. Exactly. Yeah. So imagine how much autonomy and independence that crew would have to have. So there's a lot of things you can learn by setting up camp on the moon. The concern that a lot of people have is that you go to the moon, you spend all the effort there, and it becomes a bit of a dead end. Hopefully it's just a waypoint.
All right. Well, some people have called the shuttle a dead end because it only goes in a 200 to 300 mile orbit, not very geared towards exploration. However, the shuttle's going up soon to give the Hubble Space Telescope an upgrade. It's Hubble's last upgrade before the mission is supposed to be over, and they either shoot it out into space or tow it back to Earth so it can erode in orbit. The last round of Hubble deep field photographs of distant galaxies were absolutely spectacular. Tell us, what is the upgrade and what is it going to enable Hubble to do in this last round?
Well, these deep field surveys are so interesting.
They're amazing.
They're amazing because what they do is they just sort of train at one little spot in the universe and really allow the kind of a time exposure to occur. And what you find when you do that is there's a lot more out there than we think.
And what we actually see is a way to look back in time, because we see galaxies that are in their primordial form because the light has taken billions of years to get to Hubble. You're looking back in time.
Yeah, we can get almost to the point of the Big Bang now. We're at that point. I'm told you can't see the Big Bang because there's too much static. Yeah, you have to dial through the static.
And there wasn't visible light yet for the first couple billion years.
So I mean, imagine what a time machine this has been and all the things we have learned. So they're going to go up and give Hubble a makeover and allow it to operate for another decade or so, hopefully, and continue what it has done. I mean, it's difficult to say what the new findings will be. But, for example, they're going to go up and try to fix this advanced camera for surveys, which conked out. The advanced camera for surveys, before it conked out, actually imaged another planet orbiting another star, its sun. That's the first time that's ever been done, and that raises all kinds of possibilities about, is there anybody looking back at us?
Okay. Earth-like planets is the issue there. Planets orbiting other stars. We've already discovered, already observed a lot of different kinds of planets. People think we've only discovered one or two. We've discovered hundreds.
Yes.
They call them things like hot Jupiter. They call them super Earth. We have not been able to observe any planets that are truly like Earth, small and rocky, but we've seen some Jupiter-like ones orbiting close to suns. We've got a satellite up now, a new telescope called Kepler. What is it going to be able to accomplish?
Well, here's the thing with Kepler. What we've seen so far is sort of by inference, big planets that actually cause the star near them to wiggle, and that's how we know they're there. We haven't been able to lay eyes on an Earth-like planet because they don't reflect enough light compared to the star they're nearby. Kepler is going to solve that problem, be able to identify these small rocky planets that could be ideal for life, could have water, by blocking out the light of the sun, in essence, and able to see it. So this is a big deal because it's going to point at a certain part of the sky, and we expect that we'll find perhaps dozens of Earth-like planets. Imagine that.
Maybe even, I mean, dozens, it's possible hundreds.
Yes.
It depends on how...
I was being conservative this
morning. Well, that's a good science reporter, always very conservative. And also... scientists were shocked by huge Jupiter-like planets orbiting very close to suns, not far away, like our own Jupiter. That was a shock to astronomers, and Kepler might shed some light onto why that is. Miles O'Brien, longtime science writer and broadcaster, thanks for joining us to talk about the shuttle, to talk about the moon, more importantly, Hubble and Kepler and the deep field studies. We loved having you. I loved having you.
All
can
right.
you tell?
The final frontier. Thank you, Todd.
Okay, boys, down to earth, fellas, down to earth. We've also been talking today about credit cards. President Obama pushing Congress to write new rules for the industry. And Alvin Hall, our takeaway contributor and financial advisor, has some advice for those lawmakers.
Congress needs to look at this and say to the credit card companies, listen, if you change interest rates on a customer, you need to give them some time to adjust to this.
Now, some of you think it's not the government's job to watch our credit card expenditures. It's consumers' job.
Your segment on the credit card situation in America was simply wrong in that it's encouraging people to think that they have a right to charge as much as they like and charge it at a low or quote-unquote reasonable interest rate. People simply have to learn how to live within their means, or else this country is never going to get back on track.
Here's the track we want. We want to hear your credit card stories at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
If you hear something, if you missed something that you want to hear on the show, subscribe to our podcast at our website, thetakeaway.org. Also, we spoke earlier on the show with Stephen Lee Myers from the New York Times about recent increases of violence in Iraq. You can listen to that segment on the Times website, too, nytimes.com. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. This is The Takeaway.
I like Todd.
I like science.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.